KPCW News Time now, 8:11. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, the Summit County Council met yesterday and in the studio with a recap of some of the items that were discussed. I have Councilmember Glenn Wright. Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning, Leslie.
Well, let's get a quick update. You had a presentation from the folks with Project ABC. I don't know that they were looking for some directions, as it was just an update.
Yeah, it was just an update of what they were doing, and they're promoting arts, beauty, and culture in Summit County. And your colleague Randy Barton was one of the originators of that idea.
So, did the council have any suggestions, recommendations, questions?
Well, we have a liaison on their board, and that's Roger Armstrong. So it was basically just an update to the council. They weren't asking for anything other than our notice and to publicize their efforts. They have a website. It's called projectabcsc.com. And there's a interactive poll there, a survey that they'd like people to take, and particularly more people from the east side.
Okay. Let's see. Jana Young and members of the Solid Waste Committee took about an hour to outline a number of options that the county council could use to extend the life of our new landfill. You had like seven different options. Mm-hmm. You looked at strategies and decided perhaps the biggest bang for the buck would be to implement a more comprehensive commercial cardboard recycling program. So would you do that by ordinance or by some education effort?
I think probably, you know, we'll take both avenues. We haven't made a decision on that. We could go to the ordinance route. We could do an education route. And what we found through our research, several of this county staff did some dumpster diving around unincorporated Summit County commercial areas. And actually what they found in talking to the big box stores, they take care of their cardboard very efficiently because it's a profit center for the corporation. The smaller guys and the medium-sized guys don't have the ability to recycle cardboard at this time. So, yeah, there could be some voluntary efforts out there. We could ask the various commercial recycling entities to start making an effort to pick up cardboard, or we could pass an ordinance. I think we'll probably go the voluntary route first, but we really didn't make a decision on that.
So did you have much discussion on what an ordinance would look like?
There's an example of one from Salt Lake City that we can copy. And they put it into effect a couple of years ago with kind of a phase-in period, and the enforcement actions don't start till next year. So I got a feeling we'll probably wait to see what the effect of it has been and what the enforcement actions and what efforts we can make voluntarily. We think that some of the commercial recyclers would be happy to do this because there's money in it.
Right. And so the ordinance would be punitive?
It probably would have to be eventually.
Yeah. And yeah. I mean, so, and what would it require? I mean, how would you know whether or not somebody's complying?
Good question. All things we'd have to consider when we get to that point.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, cardboard is a moneymaker, so there might be some.
It is. It's one of the few recyclables that you can actually make a profit on.
Yeah. What kind of impact does cardboard have on the landfill?
About 25% of the landfill, according to Tim Loveday, our landfill manager.
It's paper, though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Decompose?
Oh, it does. Everything decomposes in there eventually, but it takes up space, and from a carbon footprint standpoint, it all turns into methane gas eventually.
And so that's a concern.
Yeah.
This MRF was discussed as a viable method of diverting solid waste in the landfill, but what's MRF?
It's essentially a sorting and recycling facility, whereas right now we're taking the recycling down to a facility in Salt Lake. We might be able to do it here in the future, either run it ourselves as the county or have a outfit like Republic Services or ACE do it for us. And so, that would decrease the hauling costs.
So is it something you'd have to build?
Yes, we'd have to build.
And it would have, like, conveyor belts on? Like, that how it works?
Yeah, it would look something like that, yes. And it would depend upon what we decided, how deeply we wanted to go into recycling. Again, the only things you make money on in recycling are cardboard, paper, and metal. Everything else is a loser.
Glass didn't seem to be a problem, not difficult to recycle. It can be used for other things like road base.
Yep.
But and then the impact on the landfill is minimal.
It's very minimal.
Because it breaks. It breaks.
It's inert. It's something you would like to put in a landfill if you have to put it someplace, and it doesn't take up that much room. But it's popular amongst the public, and in our outreach to the public, everybody said, oh, let's get rid of glass. We can do that, and Recycle Utah is doing that now. But it's a big loss leader because it's so heavy to transport.
Yeah. So there was also a discussion with regard to more frequent recycling curbside. I think you had data that shows that curbside recycling, though, only increases recycling by 10%. That doesn't seem like very much.
That doesn't seem like very much. I think Tim said that our entire recycling effort is about 22%. That 10% may have been in the moving from weekly from biweekly to weekly. That's my vague recollection of that comment.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, and you know, there are people who want to do it every week. It doesn't seem to be cost effective for us right now to increase that type of service. People can ask for an additional recycling container if they have that much recycling. So that's probably the way we're going to go right now. You know, anybody has the ability to request an additional recycling container.
For free. There's not an additional charge to that.
Let me check on that.
Okay. Let's see. Food waste was also discussed.
Yes.
And this would apply to commercial businesses and restaurants. So, I mean, what would, if you talk about an ordinance again, what would it require?
We weren't talking about an ordinance on that, but where we were talking about possibly a public-private partnership. There's an outfit out in Browns Canyon who's starting some experimental composting. So composting food waste, yard waste, in combination. It's a difficult prospect here, though, in our climate, because it doesn't compost very well outside in the winter. And we don't have the volume. It's done in several larger municipal areas. I know it's done heavily in a lot of the big cities in Oregon. Better climate, more volume.
According to the Solid Waste Committee, the volume coming out of Park City for food waste may not be large enough to justify, but Councilmember Doug Clyde seemed to think that he'd like to pursue it. How do you feel about that?
I think there is a private-public partnership that we could we're going to experiment with. Tim Loveday is going to be meeting with that organization in the next couple weeks, and we'll see what comes out of it. And there may be some future things we can do with that type of waste. But it's very much more speculative and more in the far future solid waste plan.
So what's Recycle Utah's role in all of this?
Recycle Utah is doing a great job with what they do. Some of the most important projects are the hazardous waste recycling, which takes place twice a year. With a new MRF and with them located to another area, we'd like them to do that essentially continuously. Rather than if somebody has that, just bring it in. Education is the other one. And, of course, they do a great job on what cardboard capacity they have right now, plus glass and paper and all the things that you and I see when we're over there, since we're nearby.
Yeah, so any updates with regard to the future location of Recycle Utah?
Nothing I can talk about yet. Where the county is actively looking for a location, but we can't talk about land purchases until they actually happen. So I'm not even I don't even want to speculate on the radio right now.
Right.
But we are actively looking to find a place for them that I think will meet their relocation requirements from the city, but I can't say any more than that about right now.
But we do know they have to be offloaded by Wayne by 2019.
That's what they've been telling us, yes.
Okay. And is that
can we, if we're close but not quite there yet, can we prod the city to give them a little more time? Yeah, maybe. We'll see. But we are actively looking for a place for them right now.
All right. Let's move on to the special exception for this acre parcel.
Sure.
In Silver Springs. The council considered a special exception basically to increase that base density to build affordable housing through Habitat for Humanity. There was some concern that if you allow it, you could set a dangerous precedent throughout the county.
I think that's the main concern of the council right now. The only legal way we can do it is through a special exception. There's no real code avenue for us to pursue there. There may be in the future. The Planning Commission is working on some additional zoning areas. that might be applicable in the future that we might be able to use. But we don't know what those are going to look like yet. The special exception could be used. It's never been used in this case for essentially spot zoning for an infill. So there's a lot of danger in creating a precedent. As Chris Robinson said, well, what if one of my neighbors on Old Ranch Road says, oh, I want to put 10 units on the corner of my 100-acre property? Can we say no after we say yes here? So it's a slippery slope, and it's dangerous to use special exceptions in that way. They are going to get an opportunity to bring public opinion on it, and it's possible they could tweak their proposal that it might be more acceptable, but we'll have to see what happens.
Well, why not just go for a rezone?
There's no rezone types that we can put in there right now. It's just
I don't know, just across the street, there's pretty dense with the condos and stuff there in
Silver
Springs. Yeah,
but that was done under what they call the spa development. That avenue does not exist anymore. Now, like I said, the Planning Commission is working on some rezoning categories that might be applicable in the future. We don't know. We'll have to see what comes from them in the future, and at that point, we can cross that bridge.
Yeah, you seem to be the one, though, that was in favor of proceeding with a special exception. You didn't have a lot of buy-in from the rest of your
I did not.
Council members. So what happens next?
Well, like I said, they will get an opportunity for a public comment, and I expect the public comment is going to be fairly divided. There's going to be people for it, people against it, and I'm not going to try to predict future council actions right now.
All right.
As you indicated, I was outvoted 4-1.
Also had a look at the concerns brought to you by folks living along Old Ranch Road. You had a presentation from Community Development Director Pat Putt pointing out that the rural residential zoning does allow for animals, buildings, and equipment to run a farm operation. Certainly a few public comments in opposition explicitly to one piece of property where really, I mean, we've talked 40 pigs and 50 cows?
Apparently that's what's there, yes. And it's a very difficult issue for the council to address because that's technically an agricultural area. There are possibly some health regulations that can be more aggressively enforced there. But again, they're difficult. I actually drove by that area myself about a week or so ago. And I think the problem mostly exists when it's a very calm, very hot temperatures, and the odor just permeates and the insects permeate. I happened to be out there when the wind, it was cool and the wind was blowing, and I had to ask the neighbors, well, where is this place for me to find? It's a very big problem for the neighbors. What can we do about it? Are there things we can do where we have built up areas next to agricultural areas where we can put restrictions on how many animals can be there? That's something we're going to turn back to the Planning Commission, come up with some recommendations for us. And even if we do a rezone there, anybody who's already doing something, it's already grandfathered. I think the best personal opinion now, we didn't make any decisions on the council, personal opinion is neighbors have to start talking to each other, talk to the offending property owner, and see if you can come up with a way to be good neighbors with each other.
So what we do know is that we don't have any guidelines for how much livestock can be in
a
rural residential
exactly
zone.
Right. And both the county and state rules on agricultural land are very restrictive on what we can do. Promotion of agriculture is found both in our local building codes and in state development codes.
Yeah, several comments made about the extraordinary fly problem there this summer. So are the two tied together, or is it just there's
apparently
lots
they
of
are,
flies?
Yes. No, I think they are tied together. If you have large piles of manure from lots of animals, then you have flies. And that is something that can be addressed if you can find the actual time of day and conditions where the health department can actually address it.
Right, and so now that's the health department is coming into all of this.
That's going to be on the health department. Yeah, that aspect. That's about the only avenue we have for enforcement right now.
Okay, and then finally, the council voting to move ahead with the consolidated dispatch center.
Yes, we authorized our county manager Fisher to execute the agreement with Park City, to authorize an advisory committee. And we approved the change in positions that are financed by the county. And from a county and city standpoint, this is all revenue neutral. We are not going to wind up spending any more money in the next year and a half that we aren't, both entities aren't already spending.
Okay. Anything else?
I think that's about it.
Okay. Glenn, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
It's 8:31. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatch. Well, the Utah Board of Tourism Development recently allocated more than $3.4 million in cooperative marketing matching funds through the state of Utah. A lot of that coming to Summit and Wasatch County organizations. On the phone with an update is Vicki Varela. She's the managing director of the Utah Office of Tourism and Film. Thanks for joining us, Vicki.
It's good to be here.
So give us a bit of background, if you would, about this cooperative marketing program.
Well, one of the most powerful parts of our tourism marketing in Utah is that we want to market in the ways that local communities all over the state want to tell their story. If they're trying to bring in mountain bike riders or bring people to festivals or art shows or whatever it is that local community wants to attract tourists around, the state matches their local dollars one-to-one to accomplish their tourism goals.
So the report says that we've got $3.4 million being allocated through the state, but didn't the state legislature allocate like something like $18 million during their last legislative session?
The co-op marketing fund constitutes 20% of our marketing strategy. So we tell a high-level story through television ads that play in the case of Park City, we have winter ski ads that play on the east and west coast. In the case of our three-season campaign for almost the entire state, that runs in surrounding western states. And so that's the key call to action. And then the co-op marketing program supports that fund through, as you say, $3.4 million that's distributed with a one-to-one match to local communities all over the state.
Okay, so how do you decide then who gets the money of that
20%? We have a committee of the tourism board that evaluates every application we receive. It's a pretty rigorous process, and the impressive thing is that over the years, these local communities have gotten more and more effective at generating really clever, inspiring marketing strategies that they have to demonstrate to this committee how they will measure that they're getting what we call heads in beds, that they're getting tourists to come and spend several days in their local communities.
So is that what our requirement is, heads on beds?
Well, heads on beds is an industry term. It's basically getting people to spend several nights in a community, which it is almost certain to translate into them spending time at restaurants, spending time in retail stores, basically feeding the local economy through a combination of hotel stays, restaurants, shopping, paying for whatever local amusement parks, museums, and so forth are there.
So I note that the Kimball Arts Center will receive $22,000 out of this money, and I'm guessing that organization eligible for it because they've got the arts festival and they bring at least the artists who have to stay over a couple of nights. Is that why?
Yes. They would have had in their application the exact number of hotel stays that they think that all of their events will translate into. And I know that they filled in a really great application. I don't remember the details of it, but that's a great example of how we're distributing money around the state.
And what we don't see on the list are organizations like the Egyptian Theater or the Park City Eccles Center, and I'm guessing it's because they just are one-time events, and people would just come up and then leave. They may go out to dinner, but they wouldn't necessarily meet the criteria then, huh?
Yes, so they can also participate through the Park City Chamber, because the Park City Chamber will have a whole series of events that they may be pitching people on. And it's always best to collaborate with others rather than trying to go it alone. So I think a lot of their activities are probably reflected in the larger ask from the Park City Chamber.
And the big players locally, we've got, as you mentioned, Park City Chamber, and then a little bit more, of course, the Ski Utah and Sundance Institute, each receiving more than $200,000 of that funding. So, again, they can use that money towards their marketing efforts as long as it's matched with somebody else?
As long as they are a nonprofit and they are drawing visitors from out of state and they can demonstrate their return on investment in the form of how many hotel nights they project will be generated out of it. You highlighted Sundance. That's a great example of a state partnership that has worked really well over many years to build the state's reputation, and obviously, as you experience, to bring lots of people to spend the night.
Sure. Let's see, the Heber Valley also receives some of this money, and there it's broken down very specifically. We've got the Heber Valley corporate marketing for marketing and ski sales and marketing. Why is it done that way there?
This is the beauty of this program, is that every community can build their co-op according to what works best for their local area. And we don't try to mandate the way they build their programs. We look to them to identify what their best local partnerships are and custom fit a program that works for them.
Okay, and in all, I mean, you gave out, like I say, 3.4, but really it's from north to south, east to west across the state,
yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, the beauty of this program is that a lot of these co-ops get people off the beaten path so that they're experiencing Utah in a new way. Maybe it's road biking in remote areas of the state, or fly fishing in the winter, or things that may be way down on people's awareness, and the co-op program helps to heighten knowledge about all the areas of our state and some of the obscure and interesting things that you can do.
Yeah, and I just wanted to make one other note. Another big player in this was the National Ability Center with nearly $55,000. Again, they bring in folks from all over the country to participate in their programs, and again, why they would receive something like this.
Well, they are fantastic partners. Utah is developing a reputation as a place where people of varying abilities can come and have great outdoor recreation experiences. And the National Ability Center is becoming a national model for that. And so that's the prime example of what I was trying to suggest, is that they've defined a niche audience who wants to have more adventures. And so if we can build our state's reputation as a place where people of all ranges of abilities can experience outdoor recreation, we're providing a great service, and we're also continuing to build the tourism economy. I'd like to highlight that all of this investment ends up translating into a huge part of the Utah overall economy, $8.6 billion in tourism spending last year. And that translated into $1.2 billion in state and local tax revenues. The tax relief per household is about $1,300. You and I would have to pay those taxes in some other way, $1,300 worth of taxes, if we didn't have tourists coming here and spending their money.
Right. They come, they spend, and they leave.
Yes. Take their children home to educate them in other states.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for that update. Just before I let you go, of course, here in Park City, people keeping track of the Kevin Costner sightings. He, of course, is here producing and the new television series Yellowstone. Can you tell us anything about that?
Well, we are on a roll with spectacular filmmaking being done here through our film commission and our incentive program. And watch for Kevin Costner. The TV series is called Yellowstone. Taylor Sheridan is the person behind it. A new movie by Taylor Sheridan is out in theaters now, Wind River, getting great reviews.
And that also shot in Utah?
Yes, Wind River was shot in Utah.
Yeah, okay. Okay, Vicki, I appreciate your time.
Okay, great to talk with you.
In the studio with me with kind of a look ahead of some of the events and how that affects our transit, I have Jenny Dearson, Special Event and Economic Development Program Manager, along with Alfred Knotts, our Transportation Planning Director for Park City. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So, Jenny, we'll start with you and talk a little bit about just some of the events to give folks a heads up on.
So this weekend, we're going to start on Saturday with the point-to-point mountain bike race that starts out at Quinn's Junction in the morning and works through each resort. The event will end at Skull Candy this year. Course is marked. If you want to avoid the event impacts on the course, hit the trails at the resorts in the morning and then at Quinn's and Round Valley in the afternoon for that one.
Okay. And then coming up on Sunday, we've got the Silly Market.
Yep. So we have the Park Silly Sunday Market. There's just a few markets left. There will be changes to the event this week specifically. We are proposing tonight to City Council to charge $20 for paid parking in China Bridge this Sunday from 8 o'clock a.m. until 3 o'clock p.m. If you are coming to Main Street, entering from Marsac is best.
So will that be open? Because it's closed today.
Yeah, we're doing renovations in there today. The lots will be open for the weekend. That is correct. There is free parking available at Park City High School as always. Park Silly Market has actually paid for additional free transit direct from Park City High School to Town Lift for this weekend's market. That will be running from 10 o'clock until 5 o'clock. And then, of course, we'll have the bike valet. We'll have the residential parking zone on the west side on Park Avenue. I do also want to mention, if you have the green dot blue square parking pass, the best place to park on these events is going to be North Marsac and Gateway. We reserve those spaces specifically for those passes. And then we also have ADA spots available throughout China Bridge. And, of course, those are not charged spaces during the events as well.
Okay, and the decision to charge for or to put paid parking into effect just the busy weekend? Is that Labor Day weekend?
It is the busy weekend. And again, I think we're really trying to encourage people to make choices and to take alternate modes of transportation and reduce the traffic and congestion, specifically in the Old Town area.
Okay, and then, of course, we've got Miner's Day.
Miner's Day is on Monday. It's back for its 118th year. Festivities start at 7 o'clock in the morning with breakfast and the Funky 5K run. That's at 7 o'clock and 8 o'clock. The parade is at 11. And then, of course, City Park mucking and drilling, kids' games, and food for the rest of the day. Rotary is hosting the event, and they are still looking for volunteers. If you are interested in volunteering for that event, you can just go to parkcityminer'sday.org. And then also for the event, we are proposing tonight to council to charge for parking. It is $20 cash only between 8 and 1. That's during the parade times, almost exactly like we did for 4th of July. Transit will be running from Park City High School, and so we are encouraging people to park at the high school. There will also be a bus lane on Monday on Deer Valley Drive to help expedite the transit. This year, for the first time, Miner's Day will have a bike valet. It will be behind the Miner's Hospital, so the best way if you're riding your bike into town is to just take the Poison Creek Trail, and then right behind the Miner's Hospital will be the bike valet. That will be open until 4 o'clock in the afternoon for those festivities. And then a reminder that we take all parking off of Main Street, Sweet Alley, Sweet Surface Lots, and Park Avenue for the event. That is to accommodate the parade. So that is expected from 6 a.m. on Monday morning. And as soon as the parade is over, right around 1 o'clock, everything goes back to normal.
Okay. And then let's talk to you a little about some of the route changes that we've got planned starting I guess after Labor Day, is that when things change?
Yes, they would start on Tuesday. And this goes into our fall shoulder season. And that does include the suspension of the purple route and the orange route. Those are the routes to go to Deer Valley. So that is the purple's the Empire route. The orange is the Silver Lake route. So that will be suspended until mid-November. And then also the green, which is Park Meadows, the red, which is Prospector, and then pink and brown, which are the Kimball Junction area. Pink does come into town from Kimball Junction, and the white, which is the Electric Express, all will go from midnight services till 10:30. So that will be an hour and a half reduction, and that'll last until mid-November also. So we're going into our shoulder season. What we have looked at is that we are trying to provide these services to our residents also and to our commuters. So we will be looking over the next fiscal year as we get the new revenues in from the tax revenues and seeing if we can provide these services year-round. That's really the idea. We don't want to have these services being reduced all the time when we're trying to get people that are trying to get to work and have more cyclical schedules and everything also. So we will be evaluating that over the next couple of months also.
Okay, and that was the point I was gonna make. I mean, how does somebody then... I mean, what do they do if, in fact, they want that purple bus to Empire to continue running? And I know that when I ride it, it's full of employees from the Montage.
It is, and we do hear that from the Montage, and we do hear that from all the other employers up there and in the employees themselves as well. So we do recognize that even though our visitation may be down and the hotels may not be as full, obviously the workers are still trying to get up there and everything as well. So we will be working with the county on that as we look at the new revenues over the next fiscal year of the taxes we did pass with the support of the community. So we haven't really seen what those have come in at. They were starting to be collected in April, so we really have one quarter under our belt right now. So during our budgeting cycle, which went into effect last April, May, and June, we budgeted according to the schedules that we have historically had. So we're looking to ramp those up over the next year because we do recognize that is a burden on people that we are asking to ride the bus to get to their employment and do their other errands and everything else, and then to reduce the services. It's somewhat counterproductive.
Yeah, I mean, you can understand the frustration, right? Yeah.
I can, and we do internally, and so does the county, and especially when we're trying to go away from just a resort-based type of transit system to a really community-based transportation system.
Yeah, and another thing, too, I mean, it's whenever you get on a bike and try to go ride somewhere, it's like there's no bike racks. So is there some money allocated for bike racks in all of this transit?
There is, actually, and we did allocate money through the new sales tax revenues also through our transportation demand management program. Councilman Henney and actually all the council folks have been very adamant about bicycle racks and just having those types of support facilities at our transit stops and other high destination areas also. So that is something we will be including, and we're also looking to upgrade a lot of our transit stops over the next year and two also.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's like even to put something inside the China Bridge here, you know, a bike rack, it's like, well, you know, my car gets taken care of, and yet my bike has to sit out in the hot sun.
Yes, and some people's bikes are as worth as some people's cars as well. So not only looking at bike racks, we're looking at enclosed safe lockers also. So bike lockers will be out of the elements. It will also be very safe, but they'll also be very aesthetically pleasing and not impede, you know, traffic on the sidewalks and things. So we have to find the right locations for those. So we're looking at both of those types of support facilities for bicycles.
Okay. So again, the new transit change is not taking place until Tuesday. You'll have new schedules. The website will be updated. And
yes, and we put a lot of flyers out at the stops. We've also done some advertisements within the Park Record. Again, getting out today on the radio and being able to get that out to the community, and we'll keep pushing that as well.
Okay. Jenny, you have anything else you wanted to add?
Just want to remind everyone, if you have not yet subscribed to the text alert system, the best way to do that is to text PC Events to 888-777. We will be pushing out messages reminding people of parking and parking removal and transportation throughout the weekend as well.
Okay. Jenny, Alfred?
Thanks. You so much.
Thank you, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 8:52. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, the Park City Institute is hosting its final show of the summer on Sunday night. In the studio with a look at that, as well as kind of a season in review, I have the Institute's Managing Director, Mo Hickey. Hi, Mo.
Morning, Leslie.
So we've got Josh Turner, big country star on Sunday night.
Big country star. It's going to be a big show. Right now, it looks like it'll be our biggest show of the summer in terms of audience size. Great response. So it's going to be really a fun night to end the season on.
Yeah, he's got an opening act as well, I think.
He's got Temecula Road opening for him. They're a young three-piece, two women and a male. Real fun country. It's going to be, you know, 7 o'clock till 10 o'clock, just pure country.
Yeah, and why is it that you do so well with the country acts? Just lots of fans, huh?
You know, country is interesting. We draw, we're doing a lot more data analysis, not to be too boring about it, but we draw from Utah County. We draw from Central Utah. We draw from Evanston, Idaho for these shows. Even Heber, Wasatch County, where they don't normally maybe come to some of our shows, but for country, we get a turnout. So I would say, you know, most of our shows right now, Salt Lake is our biggest audience, followed by Park City. But for a show like this, it'll be Park City will probably be fourth or fifth in terms of turnout.
Monday holiday probably helps, especially for people to be able to come and do it.
It does, and the weather's going to be, you know, the forecast right now is it's going to be beautiful, which we've finished up the last, you know, the first five shows were a little dodgy. We were worried about the weather with some of the storms coming through, but we got lucky. Last four and this one look like we've just had perfect weather, so.
All right, so what kind of season was it?
This has been a record season for us. When we finish up the numbers, it'll be we'll have the most attendees, I believe, for a summer concert series, and this is finishing up the 14th season at Deer Valley. Again, we've started making a lot more penetration into the valley, which is really helpful. You know, we sometimes forget that Park City is still a small town, even though we're expanding, so we need to bring people in from outside. But I think we've had a consistently performing lineup this summer, which, you know, when I say this is the biggest show of the summer, it'll be the biggest show by, I think, about 10% when we tally up the numbers. But that's not a huge gap from, you know, people like Ex-Ambassadors or American Acoustic or Five for Fighting was, a big turnout. Melissa Etheridge was a big turnout. So all of them are within that 10% band, but it looks like this will be the biggest one.
Yeah. So in terms of attendance that you've got setting with records, I think it may have been with a number of shows as well, or is that
no,
about
we've been far? We've been averaging about 10 shows. I think it went from 8 to 10 about 4 years ago, and we're pretty consistent now. Last summer we were hurt a little bit with the cancellation of one show for Thunder, but 10 shows seems to be the right number, provided we can get the right artists.
Okay. So what can we look forward to? I know you guys basically take a break till November, yeah? Just trying to line up the main stage season?
Well, we take a break as far as what some of the public sees. Right now, we'll start lining up. We're finishing up this main stage season. But we have a couple of dates coming up that if people want to make note, we're going to be doing TEDx Women, which will be on November 3rd, site to be announced. That you have to be a member, and that's partially a TED requirement. So if you're a member of the Park City Institute, then you can be invited to the TED conference. Space is limited to about 100 guests for that. And again, that's a TED requirement, and that'll be broadcast in from New Orleans. November 15th, we'll be doing TEDx Youth at Park City High School at the Eccles Center. And that is students from the Park City School District do TED Talks. We work with them starting beginning of October, in this case, with teachers, with our staff. And we have about 20 students on average that speak on those days. We just looked at it last week because we were filling out a grant. We've had close to 300,000 views of Park City High School students' TED Talks to date. So it's a fun day for us. And then it's just getting ready for the main stage season. And, you know, we're hoping we have an October surprise where we might be able to bring somebody in like last year with Colby Calais. We're working on that, but nothing so far.
Okay, so when is the first show scheduled for? Do we know yet?
Usually, you know, we're looking at the first week of December. We haven't finalized it yet. This is the 20th anniversary of the opening of the Eccles Center. So January 9th, 2018, will be the actual 20th anniversary, which some people find hard to believe. It's, you know, it's just been an amazing facility, and it's done, I think it's done everything it was intended to do for the Park City community. So we're excited to celebrate that. We're hoping to bring back some classics from those 20 years, as well as some new people.
Great. So when does that get announced, you know?
We're targeting either September 25th or 26th as the we'll have a announcement party.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
No, I just want to thank everybody for the support we've had this summer. It truly has been really a fun summer. And like I said, the turnout's been great. The support's been great. And we hope we can continue that into the winter season and bring some more great performers.
Okay. Mo, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks, Liz.
Mo Hickey, Managing Director of the Park City Institute. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW.